Good morning, everyone, and welcome back again. Let's start with meditation. It's a short meditation, so find a nice comfortable posture. So we begin by preparing the body, settling the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. So keeping the back nice and straight. Allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And soften and relax all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice sensations associated with the breath. What is our basic human condition? What state do we find ourselves in? Is it one of happiness? Is it one of suffering? The Buddha's diagnosis for our human condition was we are stuck in a state of dukkha. But what does this mean? Sometimes we have unpleasant physical and mental experiences. Sometimes we get sick. Sometimes we have aches and pains in the body. And sometimes we might suffer from fear or anxiety. Despair or depression. The Buddha called all of these unpleasant experiences the dukkha of suffering. This is something fairly obvious to us. Something fairly obvious as something we find unsatisfactory. But then also sometimes we experience pleasant physical and mental experiences. Enjoying the warmth of the sun on our face. Enjoying the taste of a delicious meal. Feeling happy about getting a promotion at work. Feeling good about ourselves when others praise us. We normally tend to identify these pleasant experiences as happiness. But are these pleasant experiences in the nature of happiness? If we engage in these experiences more and more, do we become more happy? If we sit in the sun longer, do we enjoy the warmth of the sun more and more? Do we become more happy if we eat more and more chocolate cake? And what often happens when we don't get the things that we desire? Or if we don't get enough of them? And do these experiences ever completely satisfy us? Or do we simply end up craving more? The Buddha called all these pleasant experiences the dukkha of change. In order for us to understand that these pleasant experiences are merely temporary, transient experiences, that they're uncertain and cannot really be relied upon. that cannot provide us with any genuine or lasting happiness. The Buddha also said that underlying both our unpleasant and pleasant experiences is all-pervasive dukkha. But what does this mean? What is the deepest condition that we find ourselves in? All-pervasive dukkha means that in our condition there's always a possibility for some sort of suffering to arise in our life. Why is this the case? Why is there always this potential for suffering? The Buddha discovered that as long as our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions, such as attachment and anger and jealousy, then there will always be a potential for suffering. But can we do anything about this? Will this potential for suffering always be there? Or can we actually eliminate the mental afflictions from the mind? The Buddha discovered that the mental afflictions are not part of the nature of our mind, but rather like dirt covering the surface of our mind. and that we can thereby eliminate them from the mind. Eliminate them by overcoming the fundamental ignorance of a mistaken view of reality that is their root. So by eliminating this ignorance from the mind, we can eliminate all the mental afflictions and thereby the cause of suffering. And then thereby find liberation from suffering. And through understanding this, we can cultivate or develop an aspiration to be liberated from suffering, from samsara. We can develop this mind of renunciation, the wish for liberation, freedom from suffering. And then simply release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest in its own place. Simply resting in awareness itself. Simply resting in luminously clear awareness. Open and spacious. So let's begin by reading through the foundation of all good qualities. So again, we start then to become familiar with at least the words, and then hopefully start to become, slowly become familiar with a little bit about the meaning of the words as well. The foundation of all good qualities. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure Guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the Pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the Bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the Fortunate Ones, the Supreme Vajra Vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the Gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never separated from perfect Gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and the paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Let's begin by reviewing a little bit what we've covered before we move on in the text this morning. So, of course, this text here, The Foundation of All Good Qualities, is a text written by Lama Tsongkhapa. Lama Tsongkhapa was a great Tibetan master from around the 14th century, and he expanded upon the Lam Rim teachings that were introduced into Tibet through Lama Atisha around the 11th century. So, on the basis of this, then the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism was formed. So Lama Tsongkhapa is considered to be the founder of the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism, where the main approach to practice is the Lam Rim. Lam Rim means stages of the path to enlightenment. So the Lam Rim is the way the spiritual path to enlightenment is packaged within the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. So remember that when the Buddha achieved enlightenment, the first teaching he gave was the Four Noble Truths. And that was the level of teachings that spread most widely throughout India. And in the Four Noble Truths teachings, the Buddha taught the idea of personal liberation from samsara, this idea of achieving the goal of nirvana. And to achieve that, we really need to realize this no self, this no solid sense of me, this self does not exist. But then on that basis of those teachings, and this is the teachings, of course, that spread most widely after the time of the Buddha, and then started to spread to places like Sri Lanka, up through Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia. So all of these traditions have this perspective or structure to the spiritual path, the idea of personal liberation, the goal of nirvana, the idea of realizing no self. And these traditions are collectively nowadays known as the Theravada traditions. But then also the Buddha taught in an area called Rajgir the idea that there is a deeper level of ignorance than just this no self. And he taught this idea of emptiness, the idea that in fact there's no independent objective world, there's no independent subjective me. Also taught the idea of a further goal of enlightenment, that not only can we achieve personal liberation from samsara, but we can go on to achieve the further goal of enlightenment, full awakening, so that we can help to liberate everyone else from samsara as well. So this teachings then started to spread a little bit later in India because they weren't so widely taught. And then these teachings then started to spread up across the Himalayas into China, across to Korea, Japan, Vietnam. And so these schools collectively are called the Mahayana traditions because of this having the goal of enlightenment. But then also we have the teachings of Tantra or Vajrayana, which is having the same goal as the Mahayana, the same aspiration of bodhicitta, the same wisdom of emptiness. But there we're trying to tap into a deeper level of the mind to accelerate the spiritual path. These teachings were not very widely taught at all, and they only really started to gain momentum in India much later, around 6th, 7th, 8th century. By that time, of course, Buddhism had spread to most countries already, but it was at that period when Vajrayana also was starting to be widely practiced in India that Buddhism spread into Tibet. So in Tibet then, we have all of these forms of Buddhism, these levels of practice of the Theravada level of practice, the Mahayana, Vajrayana, spreading into Tibet. So therefore, what we find here in this Foundation of All Good Qualities text, we find the practices at all three levels that we can practice in the spiritual path. So if we look at the first verse in this text, it talks about the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. So here we're saying that the root of the path is to have rely on a teacher. And here we see the word guru. Guru is often implying the teacher is qualified to teach at the highest level of Tantra or Vajrayana. And certainly at that level of practice, because it's a very subtle practice, we're dealing with very subtle levels of the mind, a very close connection to a personal teacher is essential if we really want to progress at that level of practice. So certainly there, what's being said here is 100% correct, that without a personal teacher at that level, it's almost impossible to really effectively progress. But of course, as a beginner, maybe we're not practicing at that high level, and nowadays, of course, we can begin to do some practice without a personal teacher. Although in the time that this text was written, of course, probably that wasn't possible at all, because in those times, you know, the only way we would could gain access to spiritual teachings is directly through a teacher. No really texts available, and most people probably were illiterate anyway. And so the only way to even begin was to have a teacher. But even having said that, now in the modern day, of course, we have access to a lot of things without having a personal teacher. But even so, if we really want to make the most out of our spiritual practice, a personal teacher is going to be very, very helpful, because they're going to be able to tailor the spiritual path to our personal needs. So they will be able to make our practice most effective. Also, they're going to be able to help us to overcome any obstacles in our practice. They'll be able to give us, be able to correct any mistakes we have in the practice and so forth. So, of course, all of these things are all very difficult if we don't have a personal teacher. So I think even at our level, to have a personal teacher, there'll be a lot of advantages. And the further we go in the practice, the more deeper we go, the more helpful it will be to have that close connection to the teacher. And this is what's being said here in this first verse. Then in the second verse, it's talking about this precious freedom of this rebirth. And this is talking, of course, about this precious human life we have. And this verse is coming here to really help us to understand the situation we find ourselves in, that we've got this precious opportunity, and let's take advantage of it. And so this is like exhorting us to really make use of our life, to make our life meaningful and not to just waste our life. Because often we don't appreciate something until we've lost it or about to lose it. So this verse here is to help us to really reflect on the situation we find ourselves in, not to take it for granted and not to waste it, and to really make our life as meaningful as possible. How can we, and then it says here that it says to please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly day and night takes its essence. So how can we take the essence of this precious opportunity we have? How can we really make our life meaningful? And so here in this Foundation of All Good Qualities text, again, this is a very short Lam Rim text. And what we find in the Lam Rim structure approach to the spiritual path, we can talk about taking advantage of this precious human life at three levels, depending on the level of our capacity. And at the foundation level, the minimum way we can make our life meaningful is to simply strive for a good future life. And so that is the first part of the answer, is how to, at least at the foundation level, to make our life meaningful in at least that way. Of course, then we can expand our perspective, we can expand our capacity to not just strive for a good future, but to strive for breaking free of this entire cycle of samsara, to achieve personal liberation from suffering. So that's what's called middling capacity, that they would not just be striving for a good future, but they'd strive for the goal to break free altogether, to achieve personal liberation from suffering. But then on that basis, we can even expand our motivation even further to not just strive for personal liberation from samsara, from suffering, but to strive for the goal of also helping to liberate everyone else from samsara as well. So this is the idea, of course, of striving for the goal of enlightenment. So this is someone of great capacity. So then later in the text, we see the instructions about how to expand our motivation to that level of practice. And of course, in that level of striving for the goal of enlightenment, we saw previously yesterday that we can operate there at two levels. We can operate at the normal level, and we can operate at the deeper level of the Tantra or Vajrayana practice. So what we're going to see here in this text is how we can initially practice at the normal level for striving for enlightenment, and then how do we actually then go on to practicing at the highest level of Vajrayana or Tantra, striving for the goal of enlightenment. So what we're going to see is the answer or how to make our life meaningful at each one of those levels within this text. And within that, the first part of the answer is first, of course, how to develop that aspiration to strive for that particular goal. And then the second part of the answer is then what actual practices do we need to engage in to actually strive for that goal? So in the first part of the answer, of course, we're looking to make our life meaningful, at least in a way of striving for a good future, and how to really develop that aspiration is to reflect on death and impermanence, is to understand that we don't have this precious opportunity forever. We don't know how long it's going to last. Let's make use of it right now while we still have this opportunity. And so this is the first two lines of the third verse, which says, this life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. Because even though we previously maybe appreciate that we have this precious human life, we're full of opportunities, we may still have this idea that, you know, I've got plenty of time, you know, I'm probably going to live quite a long time. I can, you know, do that sort of spiritual stuff later. I'm busy now. Whereas if we really reflect on death and impermanence, we can come to appreciate we don't know how long we're going to have this opportunity. Let's make use of it right now while we still have it, not waste our life at all. And then that would develop that aspiration to really want to make our life meaningful right now, to strive for this good future. How to strive for the good future? That is the second two lines of that third verse plus the following verse where it talks about after death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. And finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me to always be careful to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. And so here this is the reflection on karma, the law of cause and effect in terms of our actions and our experiences. And so by reflecting on this principle of karma, then we'll understand that if we want a good future, then we better stop doing any harmful negative actions now, because they're just going to lead to suffering. And by engaging in virtuous positive actions, that's going to lead to happiness. So by reflecting on these principles of karma, that will motivate us to, again, abandon non-virtuous actions and engage in virtuous actions to strive for that good future. So that's what we're looking at now, yesterday, where we left off. And so I'd just like to add a couple more things to the presentation there. So yesterday, we looked at a couple of points in terms of the karma, that karma really is a process, that karma is the action. Every action leaves an imprint in our mind. That imprint gets carried along the mind, and that will ripen as a result our experience. And that the main factor here in karma is our intention. And that karma then can be either mental, verbal, or physical. We looked at the four general principles of karma, the same general principles that are operating in the physical world of cause and effect. The first one, certain or definite, simply means that the result is always of a similar type to the cause. We see that in the physical world. And here, this means that if we engage in a virtuous action, that will always lead to a happiness result. Non-virtuous action always leads to suffering result. We also talked about the factor of increase, that we can affect those imprints from our actions. It can result in a big result, particularly if we nurture that imprint. If we are happy about doing that action, if we do it again and again, we can end up with a big result. And we also saw that there is always this law of cause and effect operating, that it's not like sometimes we have certain results without any cause. There's always a cause for every result. And that whenever we do an action, then that definitely will plant an imprint in our mind. It's not like some actions sort of get lost. So these points together, what they really also mean is that just like the physical world, we can affect how things develop and how things produce a result. Likewise here, even though we've done certain actions, we can affect those imprints in our mind. We can either strengthen them and have a bigger result, or we can weaken them and have a less result or no result. And so that brought up, of course, the whole idea of purification, how to purify negative imprints in our mind. And then we talked about these four opponent powers as an effective way of reducing the impact of our negative imprints and also reducing our negative habits in general. And so that's where we were up to yesterday. I'd just like to add two more things before we move on to the next topic. And the first is that we said that the result of our actions is always of a similar type to the cause, but we can talk about actually four types of results of our actions. And the first two are, again, results similar to the cause. And the first one is a result where we have a similar experience. Which would, an example of that, of course, is if we, let's say we stole something from someone, then a result of that action, the similar experience, would be that we later see someone stealing something from us. So that's what similar experience means. Then also we can have what's called similar tendencies. And I think, again, this one is fairly obvious. Similar tendency means that if we, for example, steal something, then that would start to develop the habit of stealing. So a result of that is that we would develop the tendency to steal again in the future. So I think that one is also fairly obvious. Then the third type of result of our actions is what's called environmental result. And that is that how we see the world around us, that our actions are also leading to the way in which we see the world around us. So this one is a little bit difficult to understand if we believe that there is a fixed objective world that we're experiencing. Whereas when we, a little bit later this afternoon, start to look at the view of reality, this idea of emptiness and dependent arising, that the world that we experience is a world that is a product of our mind, then we can better understand this, that depending on our previous behavior, that's going to really result in the way in which we experience the world. And so this is the environmental result. And then the last result is what's called fully ripened result. And this is talking about the actual result of a existence, a life. So the fact that we are now a human and we're experiencing ourselves as human now, this is what's called a fully ripened result of some earlier action. So at the end of every life, one of our karmic imprints will ripen as the next life. That imprint that ripens as the next life is this fully ripened result. So fully ripened result is a particular life. And then, of course, within that life, we are having experiences, all these sorts of experiences, continuously ripening in every moment. So these are the four types of results of our actions. Any questions about those? Yes.
I'm just wondering if the Buddhist view does leave any room for coincidences?
Coincidence. So what the Buddhist perspective on that, you know, coincidence or chance or good luck or bad luck, is simply where we have situations where we can't easily see all the causes and conditions that led to this experience. So also within physics in the physical world, there's always causes and conditions happening. But of course, what we can appreciate either at the physical level or mental level, to know all the conditions that were operating to lead to this particular situation is almost impossible. And so often we don't see that, and then we go, wow, that was just coincidence or chance or something. So from a Buddhist perspective, of course, when we say that, it's simply just because we don't really appreciate all the things that were in play, and therefore it looks to us as if it's random or just good luck or bad luck in that sense. So as with physics in Buddhism, everything is produced through causes and conditions. It's just that at our level, often we can't see all these things that were contributing to this, and that's why it seems like it just came out of nowhere or it was just by chance or random. That would be sort of the Buddhist answer.
Is this a definite list of results? Because I think I've heard that karma ripens as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experiences or feelings. So where would they be?
Yeah, here. I mean, similar experience. So, of course, here, if we engaged in a harmful action, the similar experience would be a suffering experience. If we engaged in a virtuous action, the similar experience would be a happiness experience. So all of those three types would fit in here. Okay. If we then look at the text there with that same verse, it says, so by reflecting on this presentation, the four general principles and so forth, then it says by finding firm and definite conviction in these principles, please bless me to always be careful to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. So by understanding this, then we would have the conviction that if I want a good future, then I really need to stop engaging in harmful behaviour and I really need to engage in virtuous behaviour. So how to do that? And so here then, the Buddha came up with a list of what was called the 10 non-virtues, 10 core things that we should stop doing. And on the other side, then we have the 10 virtues, things to engage in. But generally, here in this presentation on karma, these 10 virtues are simply listed as having abandoned the non-virtue. But particularly here, we're talking about Mahayana, really. And in the Mahayana, we really like to be more proactive than simply abandoning the negativity. So what I'd like to do now is look at these 10 virtues from the positive opposite side, to be a little bit more proactive. Because also I think in our modern society, we're always focusing on the negative. And even if we're focusing on the negative in terms of I don't want to do that, I want to eliminate that, we're still focusing on that thing. And that, I think, it's much better to focus on the positive opposite. For example, like, let's say we want to give up smoking. And, you know, if we just say to ourselves, I don't want to smoke, I don't want to smoke, I don't want to smoke, I mean, what we're focusing on, of course, is smoking. You know? And so our mind doesn't really pick up the negative. So when we reaffirm that, we're just saying to our mind, smoking, 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 smoking. And, of course, then we continue to smoke. And similarly, another classic example is, you know, let's say we're at home and we have to go out and we have to remember to take some keys with us or something. And, you know, then we say to say, don't forget the keys, don't forget the keys, don't forget the keys. Of course, our mind is not registering the no. So all our mind is hearing is forget the keys, forget, forget, forget. And, of course, we walk out the door without the keys. So this is not very helpful. Rather, we should do the positive opposite, like remember the keys, remember the keys. And so then that's what we program. So I think, therefore, particularly in our modern society, we're so much focused on the negative that even when we talk about the virtues, and the virtues are not doing the negative thing, I think it's much better to focus on the positive opposite. I think it can be really much better. I can't remember who it was recently. You know, we talk about like these anti-war rallies. And I can't remember who it was, but some spiritual person said, I would never attend an anti-war rally, but I would always attend a peace rally. So I think this is a good thing, understanding. So what I'd like to do then is look at these 10 virtues, and rather than having them as like not doing this negativity, is to phrase it in the positive opposite. So we're going to make up that list now. And so the Buddha talked about these 10 non-virtues as 10 core things that if we really gave them up, we'd be doing well. And of course, remember, karma is not just verbal and physical, but also mental. So if we're just restraining ourselves from harmful physical and verbal behavior, but we're not fixing up our mental attitude, then it's going to be difficult. So we need to address all three areas. So in this list of 10, we have physical, verbal, and mental behavior. So the first three are physical behavior. The first non-virtue was killing. So what would be the positive opposite of killing? How would you phrase that?
Protecting life.
Protecting life. Protecting life is very proactive. So that'd be good. What would be the minimum positive opposite? Respecting life. Then if you want to be more proactive, then actively protect it. But at least respect life, I think, would be the minimum positive opposite. The second non-virtue is stealing. So what's the positive opposite of stealing? Yes, respect others' property. The third non-virtue is sexual misconduct, which is defined as any sexual conduct that creates harm for ourselves or others. So what would be the positive opposite of sexual misconduct? This one's a little bit more difficult, but... I think, again, the idea of respect... Because often sexual misconduct comes because someone's forcing something onto someone else. So I think, again, something like respecting others' boundaries or respecting others in general, I think, could be the positive opposite. So these are the three physical actions that in the 10 virtues. Then we have four verbal actions. The first one, the negativity, is lying. So what's the positive opposite of lying? Telling the truth. The fifth non-virtue is what's called divisive speech. Divisive speech is any speech whereby your intention is to cause two people or two groups of people to move apart. You're trying to divide people. So what would be the opposite of divisive speech? inclusive, yeah.
Unifying.
Yeah, unifying speech or bringing people together. The sixth non-virtue is what's called harsh speech. Harsh speech is any speech where your intention is to hurt the person by what you say. So what would be the opposite of harsh speech?
Kind.
Kind speech, yeah. The seventh non-virtue is usually called either idle gossip or senseless speech. Now, this list of the ten non-virtues, is like the top 10 list, but, you know, this sort of senseless speech or idle gossip seems quite harmless. So why did it make the top 10 list from the Buddha? Why did it get in the top 10 list? Because it seems, I mean, a lot of these other non-virtues seem quite hard, quite destructive. How come idle gossip or senseless speech made the top 10 list? Exactly. Wasting our precious human life. We spend so much time there that we really waste it. Therefore, in that sense, it's harmful. So what would be the positive opposite of senseless speech or idle gossip? Meaningful speech? So these are the four verbal actions. Then the last three are mental attitudes. The eighth non-virtue is often translated into English as what's called covetousness. And covetousness is about this mental attitude of wanting things belonging to someone else. So what would be the positive opposite of this? And I think there's sort of two things we can actually reflect on here. So what's the positive opposite of covetousness? That is, wanting things belonging to someone else.
Generosity.
Being happy with what you have.
Yeah, being happy with what you have. Being content. And so gratitude in what sense? With this, yeah. I mean, gratitude, yeah, as well comes here. There's another thing. Yeah, because normally we want them because we're jealous of what they've got. We want it. So the opposite would be to rejoice in others' good fortune. Then the ninth non-virtue is called ill will or malice. And ill will or malice is sort of defined as wishing someone else to have suffering or wishing harm upon them. So what is the positive opposite of ill will or malice? Which is? Loving kindness and compassion. And the tenth non-virtue is what's called wrong view. Wrong view here, in particular, is talking about the wrong view that there are no consequences to my actions, so I can do whatever I want. So what would be the positive opposite of wrong view? A little bit more than that, I think. Yeah, right view, or simply we could say wisdom. So these are the mental, three mental attitudes that we are to correct. So I think if we're trying to follow the advice here in Foundation of All Good Qualities, and it talks about accomplishing all virtuous deeds, then I think if we can use this sort of list, I think that would be a good starting point in terms of striving for a good future, if we can really adopt this ethical standard in our life. Any questions about this or anything about karma? Because that's all I want to cover now on this verse here about karma. And then I'd like to then move on to the next topic after that. So anyone have any questions about this or any of the, well, actually anything that we've covered so far? Environmental result? Yes. The question is?
Immediately preceding moment of cognition, mielessä, miten se vaikuttaa siihen experimental experience, minkä mä siitä saan. Onko nämä yhteydessä?
So, the immediate, what did you say? Immediate moment of cognition.
Before, preceding.
Yeah, the immediate
moment of cognition.
How does this then influence the environmental experience or the environmental result?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean. You mean like, because probably I think what's being asked is that we have all these imprints in our mind, which then ripen as our experiences. And of course, which imprint ripens will depend on many factors. One, of course, is the strength of the imprint itself. And then, of course, all the other factors that are conditions that are there. And of course, one of those conditions would be what's going on in our mind in the previous moment. That will be also a factor that would determine which imprint ripens to have what sort of experience. But it would be one of a number of factors, of course. You know, other factors would be the strength of our imprints, other internal factors with us, many different factors as well. So yes, they immediately preceding what's going on in our mind, and we can sort of know this well, will have definitely an impact of what's going to happen in the next moment. But it's not going to be, of course, predetermined. You know, that whenever we're in a certain situation, then it's sure that in the next moment, this is going to happen. That's not sure. But certainly that condition will have a bearing, an impact on what then arises in the next moment. But we know from our own experience, sometimes we have some very negative situation arising, and in the next moment that just gets much worse, or in sometimes next moment we have a change of attitude. So it's not fixed, but certainly that will be one of the factors which will contribute to what unfolds in the next moment. But there are other factors as well. Was that the question? Okay. Any other questions about anything we've covered so far? Third, yeah.
Words with respect to other boundaries, because I somehow thinking that like a sexual misconduct is easily, you can think like cheating.
Cheating. What? Yes. Cheating on your partner? Well, that would be one form of sexual misconduct.
Yes, and then like, what it's like, could you explain how it fits this respect others' boundaries from the point of view of these people who are doing this cheating?
Well, that would be, I mean, of course here, I mean, if you are in a relationship, of course, then even though, you know, if you're cheating and you're engaging in some sexual activity with another person, and they may be completely willingly, acceptingly doing that, then of course part of that sexual misconduct is that you've obviously with your partner come to an agreement that to not do that, and so then you would be not then respecting the boundaries of that agreement. So then you would be crossing the boundary with respect to your partner and you yourself as well. Because that was the part of that, the boundary is not to have engage in sexual activity with other people because of that partnership, that relationship. So even though the other persons may be quite willing, then from our side and a partner's side, we would be transgressing that boundary. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? Okay. It's just about time for a morning tea break, but just before we go there, just to review again, so what we're doing here in this foundation of all the qualities, again, the foundation is to rely on a teacher. Then the second verse was about realizing this precious life we have, this wonderful life of opportunity, and to not waste it. And then how to make our life meaningful and not waste it. We can do that at least at three levels. The minimum level to make our life meaningful is simply strive for a good future. And that's what we've been covering so far. And for each of these levels that we can make our life meaningful, the first part, of course, is to first develop the aspiration for this. And then the second part of the answer is, well, then actually what do we do to achieve that goal? So the first part of the developing the aspiration for a good future here was, again, remembering death and impermanence. That, you know, we have this precious opportunity, but it's not going to last forever. And so to really then develop this aspiration that right now I really want to, you know, strive for that good future. And then how to strive for the good future is by reflecting on karma, reflecting on the law of cause and effect in terms of our behavior and our experiences. And thereby understanding from that if we really want a good future, how do we get a good future? Is we stop negative, non-harmful, non-virtuous actions, and we engage in instead virtuous actions, and that will create the cause for us to have a good future in this life and then in future lives. So if the minimum we want here at this level is that to continue to have a good future in this life, and then by engaging in this virtuous actions, not engaging in harmful actions, that will go a long way to ensuring that we continue to have such a good human existence in future lives, so that we can at least maintain that level of good future in this life and then good future lives as well. So that's the minimum we can do, I think, to make our life meaningful. But as we're going to see after the break, we can go then to the next level, because even though we have a relatively good state, we're still stuck in samsara, we still have suffering. And so then we can go to the next level of going beyond that altogether. But that's what we're going to start to look at after the break. So now it's time for morning tea break. So let's have half hour break, have a cup of tea.